The History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's program, Bury, Beaumont and Belvedere House, the photo collection in Mullingar Library that reveals the extraordinary lives of the last men to own the country house in Westmeath. Also, a century of Irish courts. 100 years on from the Courts of Justice Act of 1924, we'll hear what changed and what remained the same in the court system of the new Irish Free State. And to begin this evening, the life and death of mountaineer George Mallory and the disputed fate of the 1924 Mount Everest expedition. Everyone knows that Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay were the first people to set foot atop the summit of Mount Everest in 1953. But there's a possibility, however remote, that two other men reached the summit almost 30 years before that. On a 1924 expedition to the mountain, climbers George Mallory and Andrew Sandy Irvine were last seen alive a few hundred metres from the top, sparking a debate that goes on to this day as to whether one or both reached the summit before they died. To talk about this, I'm joined by historian and author Mark McMenamin. Last year, Mark produced for radio with Donal O'Herlihy The Lost Mountaineers, a documentary on one feature which delves into the Mallory expedition and asks the question, did Mallory and Irvine reach the summit nearly three decades before Hillary and Tenzing 100 years ago this year? Now, we'll get to that. We might have an argument about that one. But let's first go back to how the mountain began to capture the world's imagination as soon as Everest was discovered to be the tallest mountain in the world. People immediately wanted to climb it. It would have been around the 1850s.
Yeah, I suppose it first comes to attention in the 1850s with the Great Survey of India and the Topographical Survey, where they determine that Everest is indeed the tallest mountain in the world. And it's measured to 29,000 feet. I think they were out by about 30 feet on it, you know, which was incredibly accurate for the time. Of course, straight away, you know, there's, a huge desire to try and climb it. And, you know, especially kind of the dying days of the British Empire, they want to be the first to get there. And this all kind of, you know, starts to come to fruition in the golden age of adventure and the golden age of alpinism. Now, of course, like, they weren't able to get into Nepal. Nepal was a closed country. So any expeditions would have had to be on the Tibetan side. And there was some difficulty in getting in there as well. Eventually, there's a deal made kind of, I think, where there's an exchange with arms and et cetera. And they're granted passage into Tibet. The Alpine Club, which is the main climbing club in London, comes together with the Royal Geographical Society, you know, located in Kensington Gore there near to the Royal Albert Hall, which we're all familiar with. They formed the Mount Everest Committee and they tried to put together a team to, first of all, map the mountain and to see if there's a viable route up it. It's led by Charles Howard Bury, who has his own connections to Ireland through...
Mullingar,
yeah.
Belvedere House.
Yeah. Belvedere House. He leads the expedition, an incredibly precise guy, you know, a really good person to go and organise that that reconnaissance expedition in 21. And amongst the number there, one of the climbers is George Lee Mallory. And they go there in 1921 and it's a complete success. I mean, as an expedition, it's a complete success. They produce the first maps of the mountain and a viable route is actually found up the mountain via what is called the North Col. And they can launch an assault then up the northeast ridge. They don't attempt to climb it, but plans are made for 1922 when they're going to come back and put the first assault team together to try and reach the summit.
Okay, tell us about Mallory, because he's probably the most famous climber who was there in 1921. He goes back in 1922. So give us an idea of his background.
George Mallory was a very interesting character. He was born in Moberly near Cheshire. He was the son of a vicar. And, you know, from an early age, he had a huge interest in climbing. You know, there's stories of him trying to climb the steeple in the Father's Church, for example, you know, from a very early age. He's educated at public school and then he goes off to the First World War where he's an artillery officer. I suppose he's hugely affected by, you know, the trauma of the First World War. And when he returns, then he starts developing an interest in climbing again. He takes work as a kind of a teacher in a public school. Charterhouse School, And he even actually visits Ireland, you know.
He does. And that, I have to say, because when he visited Ireland, the War of Independence was going on. The first thing that occurred to me was this man a spy? What was he doing in Ireland in 1920? Former member of the British Army.
Yeah. The interesting thing with Mallory, if you look at his personality and the kind of guy he was kind of a socialist in his thinking. He was, you know, he used to pal around with people in the Bloomsbury set. And actually, we mentioned Charles Howard Bury. The two of them didn't get on, you know, on the 21 expedition.
Bury was very much the Anglo-Irish landlord.
Yeah, yeah. And Mallory is quoted as saying he was typical of the landlord class, you know. And also Mallory was kind of a notorious kind of a technophobe and a very kind of a scattered kind of a guy, whereas, you know, Bury was a real precise military man. He comes to Ireland, actually. He gets a job working for the League of Nations, and he actually visits Dublin at the height of the War of Independence because he kind of wants to see it for himself. And he has, you know, a lot of sympathy for the nationalist cause. He actually writes, and, you know, this was a piece that was quoted in the Alpine Journal. This is Mallory himself saying, "There has been wrong on both sides, but national aspirations, a passionate idealism, are to be found only on one side." This is Ireland. "It is to the fact that Irishmen appeal when they exclaim, 'If only people in England knew, if only they would come and see.'" So he came here to see for
himself.
And
he has a run-in with the Tans, doesn't he?
He had a run-in with the Black and Tans where he's kind of jostled. They come into his hotel room and they ask him, is he a Catholic or a Protestant? To which he allegedly retorts, "Don't you know that Sinn Féiners are both Catholic and Protestant?" You know? When they hear his English accent, they let him go. But he actually writes that when he walked around the streets of Dublin, he deliberately didn't put his hands in his pockets in case that he was attacked or shot. Mm. So, yeah.
So then he goes back in 1922. And this is not about mapping. This is presumably with the intention of climbing Everest because it is there. And this is him. He's the man who actually originates that phrase. Why did you want to climb it? Because it's there.
Yeah. He said that when asked by a journalist from the New York Times. And it is the first attempt to get to the summit of Mount Everest. And it's quite a formidable team. And Mallory, it's fair to say, is probably arguably one of the two best climbers in the world at that time. And the second best climber was also on the expedition, a gentleman by the name of George Ingall Finch, who was a chemist. And there are a number of summit attempts. They get very, very, very high up along the Northeast Ridge.
Are they using oxygen?
Now, Mallory is against the use of oxygen because he considers it unsportsmanlike. The Sherpa people have a good nickname for it too. They call it English air, you know. So he's against it. It's unsportsmanlike. But Finch is an absolute advocate of using oxygen because he's a scientist, you know, and he knows the benefits of it. And interestingly enough, on the 21 expedition, a Scottish doctor was on that expedition by the name of Alexander Kellis, and he had the first writings really on the fact that you would need oxygen to really get up there because of, you know, above 6,000 metres, there's hypoxia, you know, you're in the death zone. So there's a number of attempts, and Finch actually sets a world altitude record, and Mallory determined to try and outdo his rival. There's a third attempt, and unfortunately, on the third attempt, when Mallory tries to beat Finch's world altitude record, which is over 8,500 meters on the mountain, it's incredibly high. There's an accident, and there's an avalanche, and some of the Sherpas are killed. And Mallory is overcome with grief about this. He holds himself responsible for it, and he really decides that that's it for him. But the lure of the mountain is too much.
Now, they can't get back in 1923. They do get back in 1924. And something I discovered in the documentary, now I've always been fascinated by this subject, wasn't aware of the fact that there was an Irishman in the ill-fated Mallory stroke Irvine expedition in 1924. Tell me about Richard Hingston.
Oh, Richard Hingston was the naturalist and medical officer on the 1924 expedition. Originally born in London, but he grew up in Passage West in County Cork and studied medicine in UCC. An incredibly interesting man, hugely interested actually in altitude as well. And he conducted experiments on some of the mountaineers to see the effects of altitude on the body. And he studied the flora and fauna of the area. And he was brought along. And he was someone actually that Mallory really, really liked. Mallory writes in his diaries, you know, that it's a really nice party. And one of the best is Hingston, you know, a quiet little Irish man, he calls him. But they got on really, really well. The leader of the expedition was the same leader as of the 1922 expedition. It was General Bruce. But he's struck down by malaria. And Hingston actually sends him home. And the second in command, Teddy Norton, Colonel Edward Norton, he takes over leadership of the expedition. So it's really plagued for by misfortune from the beginning.
Yeah, and Irvin, Sandy Irvin, Andrew Irvin, and he's all about oxygen. That's one of the reasons why he's there.
Yeah, well, the oxygen officer on the expedition is Noel O'Dell, and his deputy is Sandy Irvin. And he brings Sandy Irvin along because he's a genius when it comes to mechanical, doing things with mechanics. As a young student in Merton College, Oxford, he actually designs a gear for the rotor on an airplane that you can fire a machine gun through the blades. Like, and that's actually sent to the Ministry of Defence, and they think this guy's a genius. They bring him along because O'Dell had him with them on the Merton College expedition to Spitsbergen, and they knew that he was... physically fit, and he was a whiz with the oxygen set. Mallory still isn't totally converted to oxygen at this stage, but with Irvine and O'Dell along, oxygen is being used on the expedition.
Now, as always, they have a very, very small window because the monsoon is coming, and obviously Mallory is determined that he is not going to be beaten by Everest on this occasion. So he and Irvin make the summit attempt. They're being watched by somebody you've already mentioned. He's not Irish. I always thought he was Irish, that his name was, he was O'Dell, Noel O'Dell. But listening to your documentary, the accent is far too plummy to be Irish. So describe to me what O'Dell sees and what he testifies to on the day on which Mallory and Irvin disappear.
Well, the most important thing to remember is Noel O'Dell is one of the best alpine climbers in the world at this particular time as well. He's a background in geology, and he goes on to become a Cambridge professor of geology. So rocks are his thing, all right? And that's important. The route that Mallory and Irvin are said to have taken, and that's in dispute as well. O'Dell's the last person to see them. He takes their photograph as they leave the North Col. It's a famous photograph of the two of them strapping on the oxygen sets. Mallory has decided to use the oxygen because it's really his last chance.
Are they roped in that photograph?
They're not roped in that photograph, but the rope is important later on. They head off up the North Col, and O'Dell climbs in support later. Now, he reaches a kind of a crag on the mountain, and the summit is covered in mist. And he looks out over the summit ridge, and there are three obstacles that are on this northeast ridge.
The first, second, and third step.
And they're shrouded in mist. And all of a sudden, there's a clearing. He describes it as a clearing in the atmosphere. And all of a sudden, he sees two figures on what he believes to be the second step. And they're moving. And it's believed that if Mallory and Irvin were on top of the second step, then they were about 300 metres from the summit.
What time of the day is this?
12:50. It's a little bit late, okay, in the afternoon. They had intended to set off earlier, so the fact that he saw them at that time means they're going to be returning in darkness.
Now, you know as well as I do, 300 metres from the top, you were not talking about it's going to take you, you know, 30 seconds to make it. You're talking about hours at that stage.
3-4 hours climbing from that point, but it's totally feasible that they could have made there if they were indeed on the second step. Now, the second step, and I've spoken to one person in the documentary, Mountaineer Jason Black, who is one of very few people who has free climbed that. Most people today climb it with a ladder that was bolted in by the Chinese team in the 1960s, summiting team. It's no mean feat, but it is possible. And if he was seen there, then there's probably no doubt that they made it there. But when O'Dell comes back after the expedition, that sighting is called into question because they said there's no way that they could have made it up and down in within daylight hours. And, you know, was he acclimatized, etc. properly? Did he hallucinate? But, you know, I've spoken to Noel O'Dell's grandson, and I've read Noel O'Dell's writings on this. I mean, he's written in the Alpine Journal that I have never been more certain of any observation, scientific or otherwise, that I saw Mallory and Irvin on the ridge that day.
Does he ever second guess himself?
He does. That's the thing. He second guesses himself later on in the 70s, the 80s, before events, saying it might have been the first step, which means there was no way they made it because they didn't have the time. That comes from a lot of pressure from the climbing community that people have speculated. But he goes back in the end then and he says, no, I'm certain I saw them there. If you look at his diary entries as well, you know, he's on two occasions he's claimed to have seen them there. And he's very determined towards the end of his life that he was correct in his first observation.
Now, the bodies of Mallory and Irvin are missing for decades. And then finally, Mallory's body is discovered. What is found?
Yeah, he's discovered in 1999, I suppose nearly almost by accident. There was an expedition to try and find the body, but they actually were looking for Sandy Irvin. In 1933, there'd been an expedition led by Frank Smythe where they find Irvin's ice axe, and they trace a fall line straight down from it. And they think that they'll find Irvine there and hopefully find this elusive camera that he is meant to have been carrying that may contain a summit photo. they do indeed find a body, and it turns out to be Mallory's. They find that out by looking actually at the collar of his jumper, and the name G. Mallory is stitched into it. And their first reaction, the climbers, is, you know, why is Sandy Irvine wearing George Mallory's jumper? But it turns out to be George Mallory. They find his snow goggles are in his pocket. There's some circumstantial evidence, but no proof. His, you know, snow goggles are in his pocket, indicating that he was descending at night. His altimeter is broken. His wristwatch is broken. The most crucial piece of evidence of all,
the photograph.
The photograph of his wife Ruth, which he claimed that he would put on the summit, is missing. It's not there. He'd suffered really bad injuries. He'd hit an open wound fracture. His leg was, you know, it was completely broken, and he had severe rope jerk injuries around his waist. So he and Irvine were obviously roped together, and the rope was broken. You know,
now, I mean, being roped does suggest that they were trying to free climb the steps, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, it does strongly suggest that. So there's every possibility that they made it. I suppose unless Irvine's body is found and there's some proof, maybe a diary entry or something. Like the big difference in this and, say, the Scott expedition, the Terra Nova expedition, is that there was meticulous diaries kept. So we know there's nothing of the sort here. So it's left to speculation.
And Hillary is steeped in the lore of Mallory and Irvine. And he actually looks, when he does get to the top in 1953, he's looking for the photograph that was of Mallory's wife.
Yeah, and in his book, High Adventure, he actually says that he looks down the, you know, the steep slopes of and down towards the North Col and down along the northeast ridge. And he's kind of glad that he didn't come up that way himself. He looks for any sign, you know, that he can see that Mallory and Irvine had been there, like a stake in the ground, a piece of an oxygen set, the photograph, anything, and there's nothing there, you know. And one of the quotes that I love from Edmund Hillary is how he described when he eventually got to the summit of Mount Everest. He said, you know, the first thing that came through my mind was surprise. I was surprised. I thought of all the good people that had been here before me, so many good people, and here at the end of it all was old Ed Hillary, you know. So what I love about that is he's like the everyman character, you know, and that's what's so interesting about Edmund Hillary.
Mm. But if Mallory and Irvine had made it to the top, they would have been descending in darkness. And as you know, I mean, mountaineering is not just about getting there, it's about getting back in one piece as well, isn't it? That's the other half.
Yeah. So I think it's safe to say, I mean, like, you know, the first
person... I mean, it wouldn't impinge in any way on the achievement of Hillary and Tenzing had Mallory and Irvine got there, because Hillary and Tenzing got back again.
No. And I think Edmund Hillary said that himself. He said, you know, he'd be slightly downgraded, I suppose, a little bit, he said, but not
slightly.
Much. Yeah. He said, like, you know, part of it's getting there and getting back. He certainly holds the achievement of the first person to summit it. But perhaps, you know, Mallory and Irvine made it to the top and obviously didn't get back down.
What's your own view?
I think it's entirely possible, yeah. There's no way of knowing. But mountaineering and adventure are full of people who do things against the odds. Look at Shackleton. Look at people like that, you know. They do things totally against the odds. The odds were against George Mallory. But if you look at his writings, look at the kind of person he was. He once famously said that we are going to sail to the top this time and God with us, or stamp to the top with the wind in our teeth. So that shows you the kind of guy he was. He was going to get there no matter what, I think.
Why did it take almost 30 years for the summit to be actually cracked then after that?
Well, obviously, like, there was expeditions in the 1930s with Eric Shipton, an amazing mountaineer himself. And then obviously there was nothing during the war, you know. So there was they decided then in the 1950s that, you know, they would try a different route through Nepal. The Tibetan side is, they're both very difficult, but I suppose it's slightly less difficult on the Nepalese side. Mm. And when I say slightly less.
Once you get over the crevasse at the bottom.
Yeah. And then and up the Lhotse face. And then it was the development of oxygen sets, you know, of reliable oxygen sets. And, you know, it just shows you the work of people like Alexander Kellis and Richard Hingston, our own Richard Hingston, that made the contribution to that, and the science of knowing that oxygen was probably needed to get to the very top.
And Hingston buried in a very modest grave in Cork.
Yeah, buried in Passage West in County Cork. And, you know, sadly, someone who didn't really talk about what he did, because he was in the Indian Medical Service in the British Army, probably never got the credit that he deserved and was never kind of lauded, probably in his own country, in the way that he should have been, sadly.
Well, you have made up for that. You have atoned for that in the documentary, because if you want to hear more about this, and I would urge you to do so, you can listen to the documentary on one podcast from last year called The Lost Mountaineers, which goes into far more detail on this story and its Irish connection. So it's 100 years now, it's a century since the ill-fated Mallory and Irvine expedition, and that documentary presented by my guest Mark McManaman. Mark, many thanks indeed for joining us this evening.
Thanks, Miles.
After the break, we'll be looking at the life of another Everest explorer, Charles Howard Bury, and his relationship with his partner Rex Beaumont. Their extraordinary lives are revealed in photographs in the archives of Mullingar Library. Stay with us. Welcome back. Charles Howard Bury was a man of many talents. A veteran of the First World War, his leadership of the British reconnaissance mission to Mount Everest in 1921 earned him international acclaim. Fluent in multiple languages, with a deep interest in horticulture, he was the owner of Belvedere House and Gardens near Mullingar, County Westmeath, a house he shared with his partner Rex Beaumont, an English actor. Their life together can be traced through the files and photographs of Charles Howard Bury's personal papers, stored in the archives of Mullingar Library. Recently, while historian in residence in Westmeath County Council, Ian Kennelly had the opportunity to study those files. In this report, he finds out about their relationship and explores the final years of Belvedere House before it passed into public ownership.
They met probably around 1940 during the war. Howard Bury was Deputy Commissioner of the British Red Cross. He had a house in London anyway, going back to his parliamentary career in the 1920s. Rex was working as an actor. He was in Stratford-on-Avon, but he was also in London. So that seems to have been when they met. And after the war, he came to live in Belvedere.
Ruth Illingworth is a historian, author and tour guide based in Mullingar. She knew Rex Beaumont and has uncovered many details about his life.
He changed his name because that's actually listed in, I think, the London Gazette that he formally changed his name to Rex Bart Beaumont. He had been Michael Bowman before that, a minor son from Bishop Auckland in Durham.
Did he change that to make himself seem more grand or to have a more affluent background?
I think possibly to make himself a little bit more grand. As I said, he was an actor by training, but his whole life really was a performance.
And much of that performance was played out in Belvedere House, which, around 1946, became the shared home of Rex Beaumont and Charles Howard Bury. Root describes the history of that remarkable estate.
It was built around 1740, designed by Richard Castles, built for the Earl of Belvedere, Robert Rochford. Came into the possession of Charles Brinsley Marley in 1850, and it was Brinsley Marley who laid out the gardens and the steps and everything. He was a great art collector and an extraordinarily cultured man whose art collection is now mostly in the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge, which he helped to fund its art galleries. And then he passed it to his cousin, Charles Howard Bury, in 1912. One slightly strange thing about Belvedere's history and all that is that, as far as I can see, with the brief exception of Lady Dorothea Bloomfield, no women ever lived there. It was all entirely a male place, and it was really designed more as a kind of hunting lodge than as a full family house. I think Rex Beaumont and Charles Howard Bury made it a kind of family house in a way it had never been before.
So Rex and Charles Howard Bury were creating a family home. They were a couple. Was that understood at the time locally, or did it only become apparent in more recent years?
I think it was understood. There were a few people who thought that, in fact, at the beginning, that Rex was the colonel's son, because there was quite a big age gap between them. Rex was born in 1914, so he was over 30 years younger than the colonel. But I think most people understood quite quickly the nature of their partnership. And it seems to have been generally accepted. There was a kind of feeling, well, you know, they're entitled to their own lives, so they weren't doing any harm to anybody, and so they were very generous to local charities.
To learn more, I spoke with historian Dr. Jonathan Westaway from the University of Central Lancashire. Jonathan, who has studied the lives of many Everest explorers, is currently preparing a research paper on Charles Howard Bury and the so-called Big House. I asked Jonathan if Howard Bury's great wealth effectively insulated him and Rex from the wider social attitudes of the time, given that homosexuality was then still criminalised in both Ireland and the UK.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the point I'm going to try and make in the paper is, can you see the Irish Big House as a colonial space, which is transnational to some extent? It's a shared space with colonial North Africa or French Indochina or British India, in a sense that if you have a ruling elite, they can pretty much be above the law to some extent. They can insulate themselves. They operate to different values.
Charles Howard Bury was certainly a member of that elite. Not only was he famous for his explorations, but he also had a political career in Britain during the 1920s as a Conservative Party MP. However, in 1931, Howard Bury inherited another Irish estate, that of Charleville Castle near Tullamore, and he decided to bring his political life to a conclusion. Subsequently, as the photos in the Mullingar Library demonstrate, he lived a life of global travel funded by his immense inherited wealth. Jonathan Westaway describes one small, although typical, example.
I mean, some of the photographs, there's a photograph in there of a flying boat, and it's a Shorts S19 Kent-class flying boat. There were only three of them made, and they were made between 1933 and 1936. Only the super wealthy could ever afford to go on those planes. And the photograph, I'm pretty sure, is of it in Sea of Tiberias in Gaza. It's an absolute indicator. It indicates just how wealthy and privileged he was. Everybody else went out to India on a boat through the Suez Canal. It took you 2 to 3 weeks. But the super rich got out to India, and government officials got out to India, or top level in the Indian civil service, on these flying boats and on the big de Havilland biplanes as well.
After the Second World War, Charles Howard Bury and Rex Beaumont would travel together all over the globe, but one location became special to both of them, a villa in Tunisia that is the subject of hundreds of photos in the Mullingar archives. Root describes what was, in effect, their second home.
Yes, the colonel had a villa in Tunisia, which I think he got during the war. He was based in North Africa with the Red Cross for much of the war in Cairo, but also in Tunisia, which at that time was a French colony. It was in the town of Hammamet, and the villa was known as Dar el Oud, and had these absolutely beautiful gardens, because one of the things that Howard Bury and Rex had a shared passion for was flowers. The gardens were a riot of colour, and they had a swimming pool. And they entertained all the great and good, including the man who became Tunisia's first president, President Bourguiba, and also leading British military figures, Field Marshal Montgomery, Field Marshal Auchinleck. Winston Churchill seems to have spent time there. In fact, he worked on his memoirs while he was visiting there. Explorers like Dame Freya Stark and the French novelist André Malraux, he was another visitor. He and Howard Bury were kind of exchanging old photographs and memories of visits to what was then Indochina, Vietnam, Cambodia before the First World War. So this spent quite a large part of the year there, particularly the winter months.
The villa in Tunisia was, as the photos in the Mullingar archives suggest, a place in which Charles Howard Bury and Rex Beaumont could live openly as gay men. I spoke again with Jonathan Westaway and asked if their experiences were shared elsewhere in North Africa by other wealthy members of the British elite, or if they were a rare example.
No, it's very common. So there's a historian called Robert Aldrich who writes about the role of Francophone colonial North Africa as a place of refuge and aspiration for gay men in Europe, because in France, the French Republic, 1791, decriminalised homosexuality, and therefore it was decriminalised in the French colonies as well.
As the 1950s came to a close, the couple appear to have cut back on their international travel, although they remained active and prominent figures in Mullingar. A public event was held there in 1961 to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Howard Bury's 1921 mission to Mount Everest, to be followed a year later by another event to commemorate 50 years since he inherited Belvedere House. By then, however, Charles Hardbury was an increasingly frail figure. Root again takes up the story.
Charles Hardbury died in September 1963, and he's buried in the Charleville family vault in Tullamore. He left the house and gardens to Rex, and Rex continued to live at Belvedere for nearly another 16, 17 years with his horses and his dogs, and continued to throw parties, including, I think, an annual dinner for the clergy of Mullingar. And my Aunt May said he did a book of poetry, Me, Myself and I, and she did the illustrations for that. And he did a rather fascinating television documentary for BBC Northern Ireland with Frank Delaney, Vivat Rex. But his health was deteriorating and his financial situation was deteriorating as well. I think he may have kind of been living beyond his means for quite a number of years. And as I said, his very generous donations to local charities. And by the end of the 70s, he really was unable to stay there. The upkeep of the place was too much.
Given those circumstances, Beaumont was forced to hold a major auction in which Belvedere's contents were sold off. The house, as Ruth explains, would quickly follow.
And he left Belvedere, I think it was 1981. He did the agreement with the County Council. The County Council acquired Belvedere. And he moved to a bungalow just outside Mullingar near Broughtonstown. And he lived on there for several more years. He was quite lonely, I think. And his health wasn't good. And then he managed to reach an agreement with the council allowing him to return to live in Belvedere because he really only needed one or two rooms, a bedroom and a sitting room and that. And it was while he was back at Belvedere that he suffered a fatal heart attack in October 1988. And he died in the local hospital and is buried in Ballyglass.
Rex's funeral was, by all accounts, a lively affair as friends bade farewell to a vibrant presence in their lives. His death marked the end of an era for Belvedere House, and we hear from Ruth once more as she brings its story up to the present day.
For a number of years, not very much went on there. I mean, you could go in, you could walk around and had a look around the house, but then they did kind of a major overhaul, refurbished the building, and formally opened it as one of the county's major tourist attractions, with, I think, a formal opening by President McAleese around 2000. And they have looked after it quite well. And in recent years have done up new information boards that focus more on Charles Hardbury and on Rex than perhaps was previously the case.
Such efforts ensure that Belvedere House will be forever associated with Charles Hardbury and Rex Beaumont. Yet Belvedere also has a new life. Since passing into the ownership of Westmeath County Council, the house and its extensive and lavish gardens have become a beloved public space for families, individuals and tourists. It has become part of the local community, a development that ensures its story will continue.
That was Ian Kennelly reporting there. He was speaking to Ruth Illingworth about Belvedere House near Mullingar and the lives of Charles Howard Bury and his partner Rex Beaumont. After the break, we'll be looking at the beginning of the Irish court system 100 years ago.
The Courts of Justice Act of 1924 was one of the most significant pieces of legislation passed in the Irish Free State. It established the basic structure of our court system, which has endured for a century. To mark the centenary year of this act, on Friday, the 12th of April, there will be an event taking place featuring talks, exhibitions and guided tours at Dublin Castle. Dublin Castle is actually a highly appropriate venue for this event, as that's where the courts sat until 1932, when the four courts reopened, rebuilt and remodelled following the destruction of the Civil War. To talk about our court system, or how it began, I'm joined by two guests, Dr. Niamh Howlan, Associate Professor at the UCD Sutherland School of Law, and Dr. Donald Coffey, Assistant Professor at the School of Law in Maynooth University. You're both very welcome indeed to the programme. Why, Niamh, is the 1924 Courts of Justice Act centenary? Why is it important to you?
Well, Miles, I'd say that it's arguably one of the most important pieces of legislation, if not the most important piece of legislation that was passed in the Free State. It established our own system of courts. So the courts that we still know today, the District Court, the Circuit Court, the High Court and the Supreme Court. Courts, I think, are one of the most visible symbols of law and order. And I would say establishing this new judicial system and this new court system, it wasn't just about, you know, how many courts will we have and how many judges and what will they wear. It was really about ensuring that the rule of law was well established in the post-revolutionary years and having courts and judges who were, I suppose, accepted and seen as legitimate by the population.
And it all started with something called the Judiciary Committee, chaired by Lord Glenavy or Patrick Campbell, who would not have been the most nationalistic of Lords Justice of Lords of Justice at that stage, was he?
Probably not. So this was the committee that was established by W.T. Cosgrove, and their remit was to come up with a new system of courts. The 1922 Constitution had left this somewhat vague, and now the time had come, I suppose, to fill in the details of what those courts would look like.
And Donald, give us a sense of why the Courts of Justice Act was written the way it was, because there's a sense of moving on, not just from the dull courts of the War of Independence, which had become controversial during the Civil War, but also from the earlier courts, from the courts of the British administration and the Anglo-Irish ascendancy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think one of the key elements to note in relation to this is that there's a kind of a hangover from the War of Independence in relation to the judiciary, because members of the judiciary aren't trusted by the new elite that find themselves in government. Hugh Kennedy, for example, is quite negative about a number of them.
And he was the Attorney General.
He was the Attorney General at the time and goes on to become the Chief Justice of the Irish Free State. And he's instrumental in relation to the Courts of Justice Act itself. But because of what was felt a too close relationship between the executive and the judiciary during the War of Independence in particular, there was a feeling that people would have to move, essentially. Now, in part, that is done through the introduction of a mandatory retirement age of 72. And there were members of the judiciary who simply weren't able to stay on because they were older than that. But there are other members who were essentially sidelined in that process. And that's just because they were felt that they weren't sufficiently independent as judges during the conduct of the War of Independence.
Yeah, because you would have assumed that the judges who were involved in the Dáil courts, many of whom had really put themselves out and had been under quite, you know, had operated under difficult conditions, to put it mildly, would have simply transferred over directly to the new court system. That didn't happen.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So at round about the same time as you've got the Courts of Justice Act going through its kind of preparatory work, you do have the winding up of the Dáil courts as well. And there had been a suggestion that perhaps they could continue. Gavin Duffy is particularly unimpressed. He's a TD at the time, goes on to become president of the High Court, but he's particularly unimpressed at the way that they intend to shut down the Dáil courts. But the government does not intend to continue with them. So the question then is what should replace them, given that the old settlement was no longer sufficient, but this interim settlement that had been in place, the Republican courts during the War of Independence, also was, in the view of the first government, also insufficient for what they wanted to do.
And Niamh, when new judges were being appointed, there was an effort to make sure that different political and religious denominations were represented.
Yeah, there certainly was. So there was a careful mix, I think, of different religious backgrounds and people from different political persuasions. So the new system really should have the stamp of legitimacy or the stamp of acceptability for all members of Irish society going forward. So it was a careful balancing, I would say.
And you have to assume that this would not have gone down all that well in certain circles. You know, it was a little bit like the Civil War, where you had a lot of people who had served in the British Army in World War One are now in the National Army. That caused all sorts of ructions of its own. Now you have people from the Anglo-Irish ascendancy and suddenly they're back again and they're back on the bench.
Yeah, I suppose it was a delicate enough balancing process. But I think, and Donald might disagree, but I think on balance, I would say, was probably quite successful.
Yeah, I think they were strategic as well in how they kind of approached that issue to try and finesse it. I mean, the establishment of that committee to look into it, and with that chairmanship, And there was also, I think, Charles O'Connor, who would have been Master of Rolls, was also on the committee. So in a sense, you can kind of co-opt the existing infrastructure into the formulation of a new structure. Now, one of the questions that there is in relation to that is whether or not that then blunts some of the ability to be more radical in terms of the change that you can undertake. But I think it is, as Niamh says, this kind of a delicate attempt to try and ameliorate or to get on board as many different people as you possibly can. And I think they are successful in that. I think it does. I mean, there's a little bit of flack in the newspapers after the bill, as the bill is going through the Oireachtas. But I think some of the more strident criticisms are blunted by the fact that there is the involvement of these people in the formulation of the plan in the first place.
Okay, and the big figure in all of this, you've already mentioned Hugh Kennedy, Attorney General from 1922 to 1924, and then becomes our first Chief Justice. How important a figure was he when the new court system was being established?
He was massive. He was the single biggest figure, I think, in relation to this, because he is both responsible for formulating what goes out under the President of the Executive Council's signature as to the remit of the committee. He then is part of the committee establishing it. He then shepherds it through the Dáil and is thereafter appointed Chief Justice. So, I mean, in relation to the formulation and then legislative process and then bringing this into effect afterwards, he's the key figure. That doesn't mean he gets everything he wants. Mm. So he's frustrated on a number of different points, but he is like the biggest figure in relation to this.
And this is somebody who was very nationalistic. This is somebody who was at the Playboy riots and he was booing.
That's right. He had a very strong nationalist background. And one of the interesting things that there is about the Courts of Justice Act, and you can see it in some of the materials that he writes in relation to it, is he sees it in almost civilizational terms, right? So he sees the common law and the previous system of governance that existed in Ireland as an attempt to impose a foreign system on the Irish nation. So he's nationalistic in that sense. And one of the things that he wants to do is to try and change this somehow. And he's got a number of different methods that he wants to do in relation to this. He ultimately, I think it's fair to say, he's frustrated in almost all of them. Yeah. Although he's still very strong in rhetoric and rhetorically in relation to it. So when the inauguration of the new court structure happens and he is the Chief Justice, he refers to the end of the silence of the Gael in the courts of law of this country. So he still speaks very, like, in a very rhetorically emotive fashion. But I think in terms of the actual nuts and bolts of what occurs, any attempts he would have had to create a kind of civilizational model doesn't really work. Like, for example, to try and reintroduce the Breton laws or something like that. Nothing like that ever happens.
And I mean, how far does he want to deviate from common law, for example, which obviously has been in force in Ireland for the duration of, for as long as we had been a colony. But now we have a constitution, 1922 constitution. So it's different.
Well, one of the ways that he wants to, you know, put this Irish stamp onto the new system of courts is through the modes of address in the court. So instead of lawyers in court saying, my lord, he wants them to say Avrehev or Afrivrehev. So, you know, judge in Irish. And that's not a proposal that goes down well. He also wants to get rid of the attire that's been worn by judges and barristers and wants to replace it with something with a more Irish feel to it. So he commissions two sets of designs. They're very colourful. They're very different to anything that's been worn in the courts before. The wigs would be gone. They'd be replaced by headpieces. And there's both sets of design have very interesting use of colour. But ultimately, you know, this is just too much change for members of the judiciary, members of the bar, and they stick with the more traditional black poplin gowns.
Yeah, give me an idea. I mean, some of the colours are crazy. I mean, you're talking about saffron robes. It's, you know, you're almost like Buddhist monks adjudicating in court, and royal blue gowns and all of this kind of stuff.
But yeah, they're really beautiful, some of them. So one set of designs was submitted by the Dun Emer Guild. And they envisage that you would start off at the lowest court, in the district court, with a sort of a royal blue robe. And as you would move up through the ranks of seniority, you would bring in more colour elements. So you might have a russet sash or a green, I don't even know how to describe some of these things, but lots of drapings of fabric and so on. So by the time you get up to the Chief Justice, which is the most senior judicial figure, I think you've got seven different colours involved in that outfit. And they're very, very simple designs, very slim, not as voluminous as the British robes. And they were said to be based on images from the Book of Kells and colours from the Book of Kells.
Sounds like somebody, Hugh Kennedy, somebody with a great sense of style, aside from anything else. Niamh, the Irish language, I mean, you mentioned that the simple thing of addressing, instead of saying, my lord, you say, Avrehev. That didn't go down well. So that doesn't bode well for the position of the Irish language under the new court system in the early years, at least.
Yeah. So, I mean, the 1922 constitution does give an elevated position to the Irish language, but that's not really reflected in the reality of the 1924 Act on the courts. You know, there is some provision for, you know, in Gaeltacht areas, in Irish-speaking areas, to try and have district court and circuit court judges who could conduct the proceedings through Irish without the need for an interpreter and so on. But the idea of language rights, you know, that we'd understand now in 2024 just didn't really exist at that stage. And that was something that was, I would say, a very slow burn over the last 100 years or so.
And how did people react to these new courts, just ordinary people, the punters, as it were?
I would say that most of the population reacted fairly positively to the new courts, and that's certainly reflected in the amount of business that went through the courts. So the circuit court, for example, that was a very new innovation in the 1924 Act, and it brought a lot of debt recovery proceedings that would previously have had to go to Dublin, to the High Court. It kept those local. And this court became the busiest of all of the new courts that was established. And it's been described as the shopkeeper's court. It was for the recovery of debt. And it was really, really important to ensure that commercial life around the country could continue. So the circuit court was very well received by business owners. The district court, as now, is where most people interact with the system of courts. And district courts found themselves dealing with all sorts of things that you can imagine, everything from licensing issues, road traffic disputes, rows between neighbours that sort of took a turn, drunkenness, you know, all the usual things that we're used to hearing about in the district court. And again, they were visible in the community. Their proceedings were reported in the local papers. Every decent-sized town had a district court.
Did they just move into the old petty sessions courts and the old assize, the actual buildings?
In many cases, yes. Mm. And in fact, the district courts had been established even before the 1924 Act and were really sort of just regularised in the 1924 Act. So they were very well established, I suppose, already at that stage.
So, Niamh, tell us a bit about the event on the 12th of April, which will be taking place in the actual venue where the superior courts of the land had their being for the first 10 years or so.
Well, the 12th of April is significant because that's the date on which the Act was signed into law. And we're going to celebrate at an event in Dublin Castle. We're going to have talks by members of the judiciary and by academics from across the island, reflecting on different aspects of the Act and its legacy. We're going to have a multimedia exhibition, including some beautiful panels that show some of those designs for judicial robes that never saw the light of day, so we can see what that would have been like. And we'll have guided tours to show people where in Dublin Castle the courts were actually sitting and operating in the 1920s.
And that event, A Century of Courts, is open to all. There's no charge. We'll put a link to the booking page on our website. Niamh Howlin and Donal Coffey, many thanks for joining us to talk about the origins of the Irish court system. That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. My thanks tonight to Harry Booklis on sound and our researcher, Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.